Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Antonio Guterres has issued an urgent appeal for countries to invest in healthcare for all, citing the disastrous impact of chronic underinvestment that's been exposed by the COVID-19 crisis. The UN Secretary-General's call comes 9 months into the coronavirus crisis, which has claimed more than 1 million lives amid rising infection rates globally. It has also cost the global economy $375 billion a month. About 500 million jobs have been lost so far, and decades of human development are going into reverse, Mr. Guterres said. In a policy brief to member states launched on Wednesday, the UN chief maintained that COVID-19 had shown that access to strong public health systems and emergency preparedness are essential to communities and economies, and that treatment should not depend on financial status. Health is a fundamental human right and a key Sustainable Development Goals target, which the world's countries have agreed to achieve by 2030. Today, however, at least half the world's people do not have full coverage of essential health services, and more than 800 million people spend at least 10% of their household budgets on health. Ahead of upcoming presidential elections in Guinea, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has urged candidates to refrain from stirring up ethnic division. She warned that tactics may lead to violence, discrimination, and other human rights violations in a statement from her office that highlighted increasingly pervasive and divisive rhetoric, in particular references to the Malinke and Fulani ethnicities. Those standing in the elections have also suggested that violence may follow the announcement of the results, the High Commissioner for Human Rights noted. In her appeal, Ms. Bachelet said that she was deeply worried about the run-up to the 18th of October poll, given Guinea's history of intercommunal violence. Joining the call for Guinea's politicians to condemn incitement to violence and to allow free elections, UN Prevention of Genocide top official Pramila Patten urged the government to protect everyone from violence, irrespective of their ethnic or political affiliation. She also called for all Guinean political actors to send a strong message forbidding sexual violence. UN-appointed independent human rights experts have welcomed the news that a 5-year-old orphan has been released from a Syrian detention camp and is now in the care of her extended family in Canada. The girl had been at Al-Hol detention camp in northern Hasaka Governorate, where mainly Kurdish Syrian Democratic Forces continue to oversee around 70,000 detainees. Tens of thousands are suspected of connections to the ISIS terror group. Noting the lack of food and clean water, adequate medical health care or proper education at Al-Hol camp, the experts maintained that conditions were akin to torture. They welcomed the Canadian move after it was announced on Monday and urged more countries to follow Canada's example in reference to the reported 10,000 foreign nationals at the camp of non-Syrian or Iraqi origin. There is no proper shelter from the elements, and children are exposed to harassment, violence, and exploitation, the experts said in a statement, adding that people's most fundamental human rights are being violated routinely. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Professor Richard Wolff on his brand new book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. And next, we speak with Nathan Fuller of the Courage Foundation and the Committee to Defend Julian Assange and Civil Liberties about the most important First Amendment case we have going on.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
COVID-19 did not cause the current economic devastation to billions of people around the world. It triggered the crisis. It illuminated the inherent instability in the capitalist system itself. Capitalism exacerbates unemployment, inequality, racism, and patriarchy, and threatens the health and safety of workers and our communities. We are in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression of 90 years ago. Half of the American population is poor or near poor. 20 million people are unemployed. It is estimated that 400,000 Americans will die from COVID-19 by the end of this year. Most of these people will be Black, Latinx, the poor, and the elderly. The large corporations have bought out both the Democratic and the Republican parties. Neither one of these parties has put forward an effective plan on what to do to get out of the disaster that we're in. We speak today with Professor Richard Wolff about his new book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Wolff hosts the weekly radio and TV program Economic Outlook. His previous books are Understanding Socialism and Understanding Marxism, among many. Professor Richard Wolff, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Rick, congratulations on your new book. It's called The Sickness is the System. It's a great title. The Sickness is the System When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. For those interested in socialism, you're really a one-man university. You've recently written Understanding Socialism, and then you wrote Understanding Marxism. You've said that if your roommate was as unstable as capitalism, you would have moved out long ago. So tell us, what makes capitalism unstable?
Well, you know, the history of capitalism is kind of the answer to that question. You know, it started in England, at least most historians agree, back in the 17th century, more or less. And then over the time since then, these three centuries, basically, three and a half, it has spread and become the worldwide system that it is now. And over that time, as it spread from one country to another, from England to Western Europe to North America to Japan and then to the rest of the world, wherever it has settled, we have seen its instability. And here's what I mean very simply. Every 4 to 7 years, that's the average, every 4 to 7 years, the system crashes. Suddenly, large numbers of people who are minding their own business, doing their work, producing goods and services, find themselves out of work. Suddenly, large numbers of businesses go belly up. Suddenly, production is cut back, and we don't have adequate amounts of goods and services, even though we have the capacity to produce them. This is craziness, and it happens, as I say, every 4 to 7 years. Sometimes the crashes are short and shallow. Sometimes they're long and deep. And just to illustrate how ridiculously regular this all is, look at the United States. Here we are in a new century, 20 years old. We've had three crashes, the dot-com crash in 2000, the subprime mortgage crash in 2008, and now the COVID crash in 2020. 20 years, three crashes, yep, just around 7 years between on average. And so I think it is an amazing testimony to the power of ideology that a system that's that unstable and has been that unstable has been able to survive as reasonable in people's minds. Everything has been done, everything that the capitalist system could think of to try to rid itself of this instability. In the depths of the Great Depression of the 1930s, a whole new economics was developed by a British economist named John Maynard Keynes. It's now called Keynesian economics, designed to deal, to overcome, finally, this instability. It hasn't worked. We know that because we're in the middle of one of the worst crashes of capitalism in its history, second only to the Great Depression, and we're not through it yet, so it may still get to first place. So for me, it's always astonishing when people talk about the capitalist system as this emblem of efficiency and progress. It's simply not true. This is a system that has subjected billions, with a B, billions of people to the enormous costs of these crashes, such as the one we're experiencing now. People losing their homes, people losing their jobs, people falling apart in their marriages and homes, people losing or interrupting their educations. I mean, if you calculated the costs of this instability, you would have, for the beginning of a conversation, a notion of capitalism's shortcomings and their enormous cost.
Rick, why do you think the COVID-19 plague was a trigger? Was the American economy already declining before the plague hit us?
Yeah, I think that the American economy is in a long-term decline, and on top of that, we were more than overdue for the next crisis. If you understand, as I explained, the periodic nature of this recurring crisis every 4 to 7 years, if you take the larger number, 7, and you add it to the last time we had a crisis, 2008, we were overdue by 2020. We were longer than average on the upturn. which usually historically has meant that we would have a bad downturn because we had gone over the average of the upturn. And so everybody knew, everybody in the financial world, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, all of them, they all knew we were due for the downturn. It was a matter of what would happen to be the trigger. And what it was the collapse of the world economy around, at first, China and the Far East, where the and Italy a little bit, where the virus came. But yes, it was a trigger. Blaming the economic crisis on the virus is simply silly. We have had economic crises every 4 to 7 years. We haven't had viruses every 4 to 7 years. It was simply the thing, that the straw, if you like, that broke the camel's back. And I think you can see that because, in a way, the pandemic is making the decline and the inequality and the breakdown of capitalism speed up. Over the last, just to give you a simple example, over the last 6 months, the richest people in America have gotten markedly richer. It's extraordinary, by the billions, even as over 50 million Americans had to go file unemployment compensation. I mean, you could not have a starker example of the acceleration of inequality, acceleration of injustice in the distribution of the benefits of this system, than seeing in the middle of a pandemic the system continues its relentless division of people, rich and poor, capitalist employer versus employee. It's almost as though the capitalists of America have looked at each other and said, never let a pandemic go to waste, and using it to accelerate the very processes that should have been reversed, that weren't reversed, that contributed to the economic crisis. We're making all those conditions even worse.
We're speaking with Professor Richard Wolff, who's just published The Sickness is the System. When capitalism fails to save us from pandemics or itself, it's really the perfect title describing what's going on. How do you explain the inadequate response by the American government to the plague and to the economic catastrophe? How do you explain that they really haven't been able to help us?
And I want to explain it, and one of the major purposes of the book is to explain exactly that. And to make people understand that once you get the explanation, then you see the logic of the title, that our real sickness is the system and not the viruses that have been with human beings from the beginning of time. So let's go quickly through it. The proper way to prepare for a virus, which we know is a danger. Back in 1918, we had one of the greatest viral pandemics in American history. 600,000 people died in 1918 from a virus. We know exactly what it is and how it happened. That one happened to start in an army base in Kansas. Nobody called it the American flu because we didn't have racist leaders then who can attach a nationality to a flu or a virus, which no biologist has ever done. Okay, put it aside. We also know that there have been viruses over the recent years, MERS, SARS, Ebola, and so on. Any rational society committed to the public health of its citizens, which you would think every society makes as a number one priority, to be prepared for a virus because we know they come. What does that mean? The companies in America that produce masks, ventilators, gloves, hospital beds, you know, all the paraphernalia needed to manage a virus. We know what it is. We know how to produce those things. We have the factories and the materials. Everything is in place, and this system failed to produce it. Why? The answer is capitalism, the profit system. And let me be very clear. It doesn't pay a private capitalist who makes masks or gloves or ventilators or anything else. It doesn't pay that capitalist to produce those things, store them in warehouses around the country where our population is located, monitor them, clean them, make sure they don't deteriorate, replace those that do. That's enormously expensive, and the capitalist doesn't know when the next virus will come, when he can then sell all of this stuff he's produced and stored. So guess what? Private capitalists don't do it. And that's why we didn't have, and even don't now have, the masks, the gloves, the ventilators. It's a story of the contradiction, if you like, between what private profit-driven capitalism does and what public health needs. Boy, is it a criticism of capitalism. Well, we all know this. The government could have done what is obvious here. The government could have come in to the ventilator producer and the glove producer and the mask producer, bought the things as fast as they came off the assembly line, and then the government, at our expense, we the taxpayer, could have put it in storage, monitored the masks, made sure they were kept in order so they would be ready when the virus came. The American government would simply have had to come in and say, private capitalism stinks at getting us ready and to protect public health. So, of course, we, the government, are going to compensate for what private capitalism fails to do because public health is a number one priority. The American government, because it's ideologically imprisoned by the capitalist system to believe that private capitalists do everything better than everybody else, which was never true, but they believe it, so they didn't do it. So the government wasn't any more ready than the private capitalists. But the problem here isn't the disease and it isn't the virus. It's a capitalist system that not only works this way, but blocks the government from compensating for its own failures. And nothing summarizes it more than this crucial statistic. The United States has about 4.5% of the world's population, and we currently account for 25% of COVID cases and COVID deaths. We are one of the richest countries in the world, a highly developed medical system. What I just said is such a proof of failure that the only rational response is to shake your head in disbelief that the capitalist system may yet once again escape the responsibility it has for the catastrophe we're living through.
What about the inadequate response to the economic catastrophe? I read about the Trump-Biden first debate, and there really wasn't anything of substance offered to get us out of this catastrophe. How do you explain that?
Yes, that's the sad, sad reality of what it means when the two political parties that dominate your political space. But it was really clear that the condition of getting help for your business to get through this crisis required you to not fire anybody so that people got, you know, three-quarters or more of their wages, even if they stayed home. But even more important, they never lost the job. They didn't have to worry, would their job be there when the crisis passed? Would they have an income when the crisis was over? Job security was guaranteed in those societies. It wasn't here. And by the way, let me be very clear about why. Those workers that you fired in Europe, if you did that, they wouldn't have gone home to watch TV. They would have been out in the streets, and those economies would have been shut down far more totally than the virus could ever do. And they all knew it, and so they didn't dare to do it. But you don't have that situation here. So you had two political parties that argued over the details, but that were both willing to countenance, to allow massive unemployment here in the tens of millions of producing desperate anxiety because they don't know how many jobs will disappear permanently, and we know there'll be millions of those. But you've increased the suffering. You've increased the anxiety. You've increased the uncertainty for the mass of working people in this country. And that has nothing to do with the virus. It has only to do with what kind of system handles the virus and how it does that. So if you want to know why so many millions of Americans are suffering in the anxiety of unemployment and of uncertainty about whatever employment they have, and I was mindful today hearing the announcement by Disney in Florida that they're firing 30,000 people from their resorts, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's unspeakable what this system does to people, and blaming it on the virus simply distracts people from where the real sickness is, which is this system.
You've called our government a corporate state. Please explain why it's a corporate state.
Well, everything this government does, I mean, I shouldn't say everything, nearly everything this government does, it does in the name of and for corporations. And it is so grotesque that really, if you're not an American caught up in it, if you take a step back, if you read European or other parts of the world's newspapers, then you see it. Let me give you a simple example. At the height of the summer, this last summer, COVID summer, the COVID infection really went through a particular industry where workers are required to be in a cold place, very close to one another, with minimal ventilation. In other words, in conditions that are the worst possible to get this disease. They were the meat cutters, the people who butcher the animals and cut them up into the pieces we buy in the supermarket. And so the president of the United States came under pressure because the unions that represent the meat cutters were demanding that their workers be furloughed, or at least that the dramatic steps be taken, which had not been taken. The employer was not told to do anything for his part to make this a safe reality. And indeed, the whole summer, and right to this moment that we're speaking, that's what the federal government has been doing, and that's what many state governments have been doing, opening restaurants, opening schools, urging people to go back to work, as if the problem was workers not working rather than employers not taking the steps necessary. And there's no mystery why the employers don't do it. They don't want to spend the money. To reconfigure a restaurant, moving the tables far enough away from one another, increasing the personnel that you have in order to really be safe, that all costs money. That all eats into profits. They don't want to do that. They just want the worker to come back and take his or her chances. And I don't mind adding the dark side of what I've just said. The employers know that there are tens of millions of Americans right now unemployed, desperate, especially since the government has cut back on the extra help for unemployed that did exist until the 31st of July. So the employer knows, okay, the workers come back. Okay, they get sick. Okay, they go back home. Okay, I go hire some of the other unemployed and replace them. It's a horrible reality, but no one who's honest can fail to see that the economy, the government, is pressing the working class to take the risk, to pay the ultimate price of illness or death, and putting nothing comparable in the way of pressure on the employer side.
We're speaking with Professor Richard Wolff, who's just come out with a very important new book called The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or from Itself. Rick, talk about the shift of money. For the last 40 years, I've read that about $50 trillion has been filtered from the bottom up to the top. And I wanted you to talk about that with respect to how the corporate state preys upon our population.
Right. Well, the way to understand this, again, it's always like this, is with a little bit of history. When capitalism crashed last time in the 1930s, the reaction of the mass of people in America was a bit different. They mobilized and joined labor unions on a scale that has never happened before or since. They put into office a progressive Democrat, Franklin Roosevelt. He wasn't so progressive when he got in, but they made him more progressive as time went on. And we had the beginning of a program of the government to help people. Social Security, unemployment compensation, the first minimum wage, and a government jobs program. All things that are literally the opposite of what we see now. And by the 1970s, when the Great Depression was behind us, when the World War II that came after the Depression was over, the business community and the right wing in America went to work to undo the New Deal, the name of what was done in the 1930s. And they chipped away at it in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, and then went to work to finish it off in the last 20 years. And one effect of the right-wing assault on all that had been achieved in the 1930s, one effect was to shift wealth from the bottom and the middle of our income distribution to the top. We have lived over the last 35 years in a system that massively redistributed wealth from the poor and from the middle class to the people at the top, relentlessly, one way after another. I'm going to only mention two because they were two major ways this was done. Number one, the burden of taxation was shifted. Just let me give you an idea. The top income tax bracket in the United States, the rate at which people pay who have the highest incomes, the richest people got a tax cut of enormous size that the middle class did not get and that the poor did not get. A radical shifting of the burden of paying for the government from the rich onto the middle and the poor. And if you add to that the rich people's ability to hide money outside the United States, well, then the redistribution of wealth through that escaping of taxes in the way that you saw just in the last couple of days, the revelation of Mr. Trump's non-payment of taxes, that is very widespread among the richest of our country. The second way redistribution happened is even more profound. Since the 1970s, wages stopped going up. By that I mean real wages, what you can afford to buy with the wages you get. And we measure that by looking at how much money you get in your pay envelope versus how much you have to pay for the goods and services you buy. You're not ahead if you get a 10% wage increase, but all the prices you pay also go up 10%. You're not ahead when that happens. So we call the real wage the measure of what you can actually afford to buy. Real wages in the United States were rising for a century before the 1970s. But since the 1970s, they haven't gone anywhere. The real wage, what you can afford to buy with the wage an average American gets, is no greater right now as we're speaking than it was in the late 1970s. That's a staggering fact that the last 40 years have seen no increase in the basic bundle of goods and services an average American worker can earn. Because over those same 40 years that the wages went nowhere, the productivity of American workers went up. Every year, American workers produced more, partly because they had better educations, partly because they worked harder, partly because they had better capital and equipment to work with. You know, the last 40 years instituted the computer, then the robot, then artificial intelligence. So workers became more and more productive. And remember, worker productive simply means how much stuff the worker produces for the employer for every hour that he works. So what the workers gave the employers rose every year with rising productivity. But what the employer gives to the worker, the wage, was flat. There you have it. The mass of workers got a constant income. As they produced more and more, it went into the hands of the employers, who became richer and richer. That's where the gap between rich and poor really originates, in that inequality. And then all the rich had to do, as they cashed in on this wonderful system, was to use a part of their money to buy the politicians, to change the taxes, to give them an even greater advantage. I mean, if you look at it honestly, the last 40 years have been a colossal ripoff of the middle and lower incomes in this country. And it has driven the American working class, who were not prepared for this kind of experience, who were told they lived in a nirvana that could only get better, they are very, very angry. And one of the symptoms of the anger of the working class at being abused by this redistribution of wealth is shown in the Proud Boys, in the behavior of a Trump. He speaks to that kind of rage and anger, even if the explanation and solution for it that he offers is horrifically dishonest and ineffective.
Richard Wolff, you've written a very good book called The System, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. There's a lot of talk about, well, we just got to get through this now, things will go back to normal. What do you say in response to that kind of position?
Well, you know, I throw up my hands in disbelief. What in the world can you mean by normal? Normal is what got us here. Normal, going back to where we were, it's the equivalent of saying to somebody who just got thrown off a train a few minutes before it hit a stone wall that, you know, you don't feel well, you got thrown off the train. Well, maybe you should just get back on the train. Things were quite nice before you were thrown off. No, they're not nice. If you get back on that train, you're going to be on it when it hits the wall. We are a society that was already, as we just finished discussing, redistributing wealth in a way that hurt the vast majority and benefited the tiny employer minority in our society. We don't want to get back on that train. We don't want to get back into that economy. That's the kind of economy that proved itself incapable of preparing for this virus, incapable of containing the virus, incapable of using this difficulty for all of us to make us less unequal, has in fact made us more unequal. I mean, this system is a disaster and has been a disaster for 40 years. To go back to what we were is simply to literally program the repetition. We've been through the crisis of 2000. It was bad. Then we went through the crisis of 2008. It was worse. Now we're in the crisis of 2020. It's still worse. If we don't change the way we act, look at the progression of what we are going through.
You write about that we just can't be satisfied with minor reforms, tinkering around the edges, that we've got to think big. How would you reset and restructure the entire system?
Well, I have a basic proposal that I advocate everywhere I go, and that says the root problem here is the way we have organized businesses, offices, factories, stores, enterprises in general. We have organized them in a way that we're now seeing the fruits of, and those fruits are rotten. Let me explain briefly. We allow a tiny minority of people in every office, every store, and every factory to make all the decisions. It's the owner or the owner's family or the board of directors or the major shareholders. It doesn't matter. It's always a tiny number of people. Most corporations' board of directors has 10, 20 people in it. That's all. The vast majority of people in any economy that's capitalist are the employees. But now let's look at how the enterprise works. A tiny number of people at the top, a minority, and a small one at that, make all the decisions. The board of directors decides what the company produces, what technology it uses, where the production is taking place, and what's going to be done with the products that we all help to produce. The employees, the vast majority, are excluded from that decision. Well, then why are we surprised if you give all the power inside every enterprise to a tiny group at the top? Guess what? They're going to use and run that enterprise to benefit themselves, and that's what they do. They provide dividends to their shareholders. They provide wild pay packages to their top executives. They take care of themselves first. And when there's an economic difficulty, they fire their employees to save money. Okay, there's your problem. If you want an economy to work differently, really differently, no more talk of this get back to normal, then you have to change that. If you want the economy to work for all the people, well, then you have to give all the people the power. What do I mean? You got to change the way you organize business. No more small minority at the top. Businesses have to be run democratically by all the people in them. The whole point is one person, one vote, to make the enterprise democratic. If we're really a democratic society, we should have done that from the beginning. We never did. And believe me, if enterprises were run democratically by all the people in them, they wouldn't give a handful of them millions of dollars and everybody else can't put their kid through college. That we would never have the kind of inequality that we have. And we would never have unemployment either, because working people understand the scourge that unemployment is. And they would take a simple step, for example. If you can't employ all the people who need jobs in your enterprise, well, that's what the government's there for. The government is the employer of last resort. There's plenty of things that need to be done, and the government can step up and be part of that process, setting up what are called worker co-ops, both in the private sector and in the public sector, and then we would have a different economic system. We have to make that change. You know, we got rid of the old system of master and slaves. We got rid of the old systems of lords and serfs that we call feudalism. Capitalism, unfortunately, continued that pattern. Small group of people at the top and a mass of people at the bottom. And that has to be understood as the obstacle we face. We can get beyond it. We should get beyond it. And nothing makes that clearer than the pandemic and the crash we're living through.
And you've written about it in a wonderful new book, The Sickness is the System. Rick Wolf, how can people get a hold of your new book?
The easiest way is to go to our website, where you can order it. It'll be sent to you immediately. And the website is simple. It's called democracyatwork.info. All one word, democracyatwork.info. Go there and you'll see exactly how to click, and the book will be sent to you.
What do you want people to take away from your book?
That they have to learn not to be distracted by this or that excuse, by this or that fake argument about where our problem lies. We have an economic system that works for a tiny minority. And as it has a growing difficulty in the world, whether it be competition from the Europeans or competition from the Chinese, or the pressures of a population whose needs are not being met, this system is becoming more and more desperate. We really have a choice, either to change this system for our own benefit or to risk going down with it, because its time historically is coming to an end. Every economic system is born, evolves, and dies. Slavery did, feudalism did, ancient tribal economies did. Capitalism's turn is now. It was born, it evolved over time, and it is now passing away, and we have to come to terms with what that means.
Richard Wolf, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. I can't thank you enough for your hard work over the years. Like I said at the beginning, you've been a one-man university, and we're all so grateful for what you've been doing. Thanks again for being on Law and Disorder.
And thank you, Michael, for an important program that you produce. I'm flattered that you were interested. It was very good to talk with you.
You take it easy, Rick. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The decline of democracy and the rule of law, already advanced under Obama, has accelerated under Trump. By his own admission, it is widely known that Trump will not consent to leaving office if he loses the election. What is not so widely known is the case that he caused to be prosecuted against journalist and whistleblower Julian Assange. Assange is being railroaded in the Old Bailey Courthouse in London in an effort by the U.S. government, in collaboration with its British ally, and send him to the federal court in the Eastern District of Virginia to be tried under the 1917 Espionage Act. Assange told the truth about American war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan back in 2010. He's 49 years old and is in terrible mental and physical health. If he loses and is sent to the Eastern District of Virginia for trial and successfully prosecuted, which is a given, it will be the death of free journalism and a blow to the First Amendment, which is a keystone of our democracy because it involves the right to learn. We speak today with Nathan Fuller, who has been attending Julian Assange's extradition hearing in London. He's the director of the National Committee to Defend Julian Assange and Civil Liberties, and he works with the organization, the Courage Foundation. Nathan Fuller, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Appreciate it.
Nathan, please talk about the conditions that Julian Assange would face both in jail and in prison in the United States, and why does this matter? I mean, what kind of physical and mental shape is he in, and what did the expert witnesses who were called on his behalf have to say?
Yeah, so this all goes to an issue with extradition, which is that in the British law and US-UK extradition treaties, you cannot extradite somebody if it would be unjust or oppressive to do so. And under the Convention on Human Rights, under Article 3, you can't extradite somebody who, if they would face torture or inhumane punishment. And so that is all what that testimony was about. So we heard how he's doing on this side and what it would be like on the other side. So in the UK, we heard about his physical and mental health deteriorating over recent years, and the fact that he's been diagnosed with Asperger's, with clinical depression, and has unfortunately even at increased risk of suicide. Now, for Julian's privacy, we only talk about this as much as it's relevant to the case and try to respect his privacy otherwise. But it's really important for the case because if it turns out that his condition is such that sending him to an abusive prison, and that's what the prison conditions come in, if that would mean, you know, cruel or unjust and oppressive conditions, then they have to bar the extradition on that basis. And so we've heard a lot about, from lawyers and prison experts here in the United States, about what the conditions he would face are like. So as a national security case, as a high-profile prisoner, as somebody with, they think, you know, more national security information to potentially leak, all the experts agree that Julian Assange would be sent, first of all, to Alexandria Detention Center, where he would be in the Eastern District of Virginia for the court case that he would then have to go to. But they also agree that he would very likely be held in solitary confinement. And furthermore, he would be held under SAMs, Special Administrative Measures. These are the incredibly draconian restrictions on top of solitary confinement or any other condition that the prison might impose. These are imposed by the Attorney General, and they extremely limit a prisoner's ability to communicate with the outside world, even more so than regular solitary confinement. These prisoners even have difficulty speaking to their lawyers, to their family, and it's just incredibly isolating. And so all of this we heard from several experts in medical fields, prison fields, attorneys who have represented clients under this would be extremely deleterious to Julian Assange's health. And so that's what's at issue this week in Assange's hearing.
What are the conditions like now? I mean, he's been in Belmarsh prison for over a year. Has this led to the deterioration of his mental and physical health?
It has, and especially late last year, we heard that he was in a severe depressive episode, and he had been in prison for a long time at that point after several years of arbitrary detention in the Ecuadorian embassy. So he was transferred to the medical wing. He spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. Thankfully, though, now he is out of solitary confinement. And so actually, the current UK prison conditions are far better than what he would face in the United States. You know, we heard about both pre- and post-trial potential prison conditions in the U.S. And so the Alexandria prison is where they agree he would be sent to for pre-trial. But post-trial, they expect, and the defense has argued at length about this and they have substantial evidence saying so, that he would be sent to the highest security prison in the United States, ADX Florence in Colorado. This is has been referred to by previous wardens of the prison as a clean version of hell, as not fit for human habitation. It's just an incredibly isolating place. It's designed, some people who have been there have said, designed specifically for to keep all inmates in solitary confinement. And so we heard a lot about what the ADX Florence is like, what SAMs are like, and the extremely limited options you have to appeal or challenge your conditions if you're placed under this kind of prison regime. And so while Assange has had difficulty in the UK prison, it's clear that what he would be sent to in the United States is far more dangerous and far more deleterious for his health.
Yeah, I mean, he'd be completely cut off, even having difficulty speaking with his lawyers. What is it, one phone call a month to his family or one a week?
One a month, we heard.
Yeah, one a month. I mean, he'd be totally isolated, even from fellow prisoners.
Phone calls would be monitored by the FBI. His family visits would be extremely curtailed, very draconian and really dangerous.
Well, that kind of isolation has been held to be torture, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's been called psychological torture, and Nils Melzer, the current UN rapporteur on torture, makes a point to note that that is not torture light. It is just harder to see. It's because it's psychological torture. It's just less visible to the naked eye, and it's just incredibly damaging.
What about his physical health, his dental problems, his shoulder problems? Has he had any chance to get attended by a doctor for those?
So we get a sense that he's been able to have some treatment in the medical wing, but he has not been taken out of the Belmarsh prison to get physical medical care. And a group of over 60 doctors, beginning in late November, I believe, of 2019, have written to the British government asking for him to be taken out of Belmarsh prison and into a university hospital or another nearby hospital for serious, adequate medical care. So we don't get the impression that he's had everything taken care of, all the chronic issues, but he's gotten some limited bit of medical care while in Belmarsh.
Nathan, let me ask you about Patrick Eller, the forensic computer expert who testified for Assange. What did he say, and why does that matter?
Yeah, so this is somebody who's been a digital forensic expert for the U.S. Army for a long time, and now he has his own forensics company. He examined the evidence in this case, and he examined the transcript from the Chelsea Manning court-martial, because what at issue in his testimony is the alleged discussion between Chelsea Manning and with Julian Assange, in which the government alleges they agreed to crack a password and to try to steal more information for Chelsea to leak to Julian. What Eller came and brought to the court was an explanation of why the government misunderstands the technical evidence in this case, and their argument really does not hold water. It turns out that they can't even prove that the person on the other end of the conversation was Julian Assange. They can't show that Chelsea Manning would get any wider access to this, to any database. She had already leaked the war logs and Guantanamo Bay detainee assessment briefs, the rules of engagement, everything except for the State Department cables she had already leaked and she already had access to. And she wasn't even trying to anonymize herself, as others might have thought. It turns out to be something far more innocuous than the nefarious way that the government has tried to portray it. It seems most likely that Chelsea was just trying to download movies and music to her computer the way other soldiers do, without the fear, you know, without her superiors finding out. So this grand, elaborate hacking conspiracy, which is kind of the underpinning argument for the rest of the government's charges, fell apart under Patrick Eller's scrutiny.
What evidence came out about Julian Assange's crime being a political one? Why is that important? I mean, the judge said that the election in the United States may have an impact on this. What's the nature of a political crime? And can you extradite somebody in England if what they've done is a political crime.
Yeah, so that is why this is incredibly important. You cannot extradite someone for a political offense. That specific bar in the U.S.-UK extradition treaty. And that's why it was surprising and very interesting that the judge realized that before even, you know, that part was brought up by the defense, was that the U.S. election is coming up. The arguments and testimony will likely be done before it, but her ruling won't come till after it. And actually, she said it probably won't come until early 2021 now. But so she asked if this election would play an impact in how the defense argued their case. And so I think that shows she really understands that, you know, we've heard a lot of testimony about the fact that the Obama administration, as bad as they were on whistleblowers and using the Espionage Act against leakers, they made the decision not to prosecute the publisher. They stopped just short of that, saying that while you can't leak the documents, you can publish them, because what they called the First Amendment problem or the New York Times problem. There's no sensible legal argument that you can prosecute WikiLeaks and not prosecute the New York Times. So the fact that the Obama administration decided clearly not to prosecute, and the fact that Trump, years later, with no new evidence, decided to prosecute, is in itself evidence of a political or at least politically motivated prosecution. We also have statements from Mike Pompeo calling out WikiLeaks and Assange specifically, and Jeff Sessions, the former head of the DOJ, saying that Assange's arrest was his personal priority. All of this points to this being an extremely political prosecution, on top of the fact that espionage, and there are 17 counts of the 18 under the Espionage Act, is a classic political offense. It's against the head of a state or, you know, the government of a state. So a lot of evidence toward the idea that it's a political prosecution.
Julian's deeply feared and hated by the American establishment. For example, Hillary Clinton has called for him to be assassinated by a drone. What kind of support is Julian getting and from whom?
Yeah, so he gets hated by the establishment, by the very people that he exposed. I wonder if it's even a little bit personal for someone like Hillary, who he exposed a lot of her crimes and deceitful activity in not just the DNC leaks, but back in when she was Secretary of State in 2010 in the diplomatic cables. But the rest of the establishment he exposed as one that overlooks war crimes and corruption and massive abuse and put all of this evidence for everyone to see. So clearly hated for that reason. But there are lots of support actually from, and while they've been very quiet in the years leading up to it, the heads of every newsroom realize that this is a dangerous prosecution. And so the New York Times, the Guardian, the Washington Post, their executive editors have all come out and said, this is a dangerous prosecution and it's got to be stopped. We've also seen great support from their large groups of journalists, doctors, lawyers, and regular supporters around the world have come out in different forms to demonstrate their support. And so here in the U.S., we've been building up this group, and I'm writing for us at AssangeDefense.org, this national committee for Julian Assange, and we're seeing finally a lot more support build up across the U.S.
Nathan Fuller, Amnesty International Organization, PEN, major news outlets have all been squeezed out of covering the extradition hearing as it's actually going on. Can you expand on that, about the nature of this hearing?
Yeah, that was a surprise announced in court on the very first day of these resumed extradition hearings. The judge, Vanessa Baratzer, announced that 40 people or organizations had been given access. You know, we watch the press, credentialed press watch by video link, a live stream, the hearings. 40 organizations or individuals have had their access revoked, and this include, as you say, these top organizations like PEN, Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders. And these are people who do legal observing, you know, trial monitoring for a living in, you know, countries all around the world, Turkey. And they talk about the fact that this is the most restricted that they've ever been. They've just been kicked out of the hearings and with no good reason why. So we've had to, us independent media who are there every day covering it, just trying to get the word out and let people know what's happening.
What does that say about the power of the United States?
Well, yeah, I think that's something it's important to know that, you know, I think U.S. and people in America have kind of been able to think of this as just a U.K. affair. He's over there, and it's up to them to send him here or not. But the U.S. has the power to end this whole prosecution in a minute if they want, just the stroke of a pen to rescind the extradition request and drop the prosecution. But it looks like this is a U.K. matter, but it turns out behind the scenes, the U.S. is calling the shots.
Well, the extradition hearing has been going on now for several weeks. At this point, are you more or less hopeful that the judge will throw out the American extradition request?
You know, I think the defense has done an incredible job. Their witnesses have been, experts in the field, incredibly detailed and thorough, comprehensive in their explanations. And I think they've given the judge substantial reasons to throw this case out. They've shown why it's political. They've shown why his health would be endangered. And they've shown why this is a brand new, unprecedented prosecution for publishing under the Espionage Act, and it does not deserve to go forward, that the First Amendment should be protecting. So while we didn't expect a whole lot at the outset with the judge reading some pre-written rulings and deciding in the government's favor, I think the defense has put on an incredible case here and given her every opportunity to throw it out.
What kind of timetable are we looking at here, assuming that the judge doesn't do the right thing and there are appeals? When do you think they could get their hands on Julian?
Yeah, this could be a very long process. After this is the magistrate's court level in the UK. Above that is the UK High Court. Could go to the UK Supreme Court, and even then it could be appealed up to the European Court of Human Rights. After all of that, then they could finally send him to the United States, but that whole process could take years, really. We're already into 2021 for a ruling on this case. An appeal maybe would be next summer, and the High Court could take till the end of next year even, really depends. A legal advisor to Assange, Renata Avila, put it this way, that if it would be beneficial for Assange to go for things to move fast, then they'll go slowly. And if it would be beneficial for delays and more time for the defense, everything goes quick. So I think they've been able to kind of get what they want in terms of timing, but go through every level of that legal process, we could be several years away.
Several years, and they got Julian Assange where they want him, not working incommunicado, entombed, really, in Belmarsh prison. What do you think's at stake here, Nathan? What happens if we lose?
Well, yeah, it's incredibly high stakes for Julian personally, obviously. This could mean, the rest of his life in prison. He's threatened with 175 years. And just as you say, the fact of him being in prison is a detriment to the rest of us. He's not doing the great work of WikiLeaks, not keeping us informed. And, just today, the other day, the New York Times was able to post about Donald Trump's tax records, but they didn't leak the files themselves. And so we see the kind of contrast with the great journalism that WikiLeaks could provide. But then if this prosecution were allowed to go all the way forward, I really see it as the end of the First Amendment, or certainly the protections on speech and publishing. I don't see how any journalist could feel comfortable after this kind of a prosecution and conviction, dealing with government documents, which, as many national security reporters have said, is their everyday activity. Their everyday basic journalistic activity would now be illegal. So that's what we're looking at.
I want our listeners to get a pen or a pencil, because I'm going to ask you, how can people learn more about your work, Nathan Fuller, and the work of the Courage Foundation and the Committee to Defend Julian Assange and Civil Liberties? Can you tell us what websites they can go to and how they can come to support Julian Assange?
Sure. So yeah, our committee and where I've been writing is assangedefense.org. Check out my live blog for the daily hearing reports. You can also see there where I'm live tweeting the proceedings, and that's at Defense Assange. And we have the Courage Foundation has compiled defend.wikileaks.org for a kind of a bigger set of resources in the case. It has more thorough timelines and history and legal documents and other things that you might need on the case. But so AssangeDefense.org for these daily reports.
The committee has been pulled together with three prestigious American political activists, Noam Chomsky, D.
Daniel Ellsberg, Alice Walker. What's the name of that committee again?
Yeah, so that's U.S. National Committee to Defend Julian Assange and Civil Liberties. And those three great co-chairs were all part of a panel event talking about Assange's case, his great work, why it's so important that we all get involved in his defense. And you can find that on our site as well, assangedefense.org.
Nathan Fuller, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time. I want to thank you very much for your good work and for your appearance on Law & Disorder Radio. And we'll be checking back in with you. Good luck and keep it up.
Thanks, Michael. Really appreciate it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.